Hello, I'm Jenny Longdon, and this is a new history podcast for Mail Plus. On today's episode, we're looking at the scientists who were the backbone of Britain's war effort in World War II, and the long and sometimes troubled history of mixing science and politics. Scientific breakthroughs were crucial to Britain's victory in World War II, from the Bletchley Park codebreakers to the famous Dam Busters bouncing bombs.
Almost the whole world is locked in deadly struggle, armed with the most terrible weapons which science can devise.
Prime Minister Winston Churchill was himself a technology enthusiast and hung on the words of his scientific advisers. Their innovations galvanised Britain's war effort, but the influence of one in particular, known as the Prof, has been blamed for hundreds of thousands of deaths. Joining me to discuss this is historian and author Nigel Jones. Nigel Jones, thanks so much for joining us on Mail Plus. Just tell me, first of all, we're talking about Churchill, his reliance on tech and science during especially the Second World War.
Yes.
How much was that a big thing for him?
It has always been a big thing throughout his political life. I mean, one aspect of Churchill you don't hear too much about is that he was the father of the tank, even though responsibility for the tank wasn't anything to do with him in the First World War. He was First Lord of the Admiralty. He ran the Navy. But he had this pet project. He'd read sci-fi books by H.G. Wells and people like that, which predicted the arrival of this monstrous landship, as they first called them. And he pushed the project forward with typical Churchillian energy, which is why Britain was the first country to actually field the tank, which, of course, revolutionised warfare in the 20th century.
Mr. Churchill goes among the tanks. The visit is to witness operational exercises of all types of mechanised equipment. It was in the last war, when the tank was first conceived, that Mr. Churchill, with others, saw its vast potentialities as an offensive weapon. It was he who sponsored the idea.
So he was always very keen on the latest technical developments. He wanted to get a pilot's license when he was already into early middle age, until his wife stopped him because she thought it was highly dangerous, as it was at that time. And so he always had an eye on technical developments right from the word go.
And that was brought into sharper focus during the Second World War. Just tell me a little about that.
Absolutely. He was the particular key man in this, was a close crony of Churchill's who happened to be a top scientist. He was a guy called Frederick Lindemann, and he was a professor of experimental philosophy, as they called it, which actually meant physics, at Oxford. And Churchill always called him the Prof. And they moved in the same upper country house social circles. It's not quite clear who introduced Churchill to him, but they took to each other, which was quite weird because Lindemann was the opposite of Churchill in almost every way. He was a teetotaler, he was a vegetarian, he certainly didn't like carousing late into the night like Churchill and his usual cronies did. But he had a brilliant gift of formulating difficult and complex scientific concepts simply, so that Churchill and indeed other people could understand it. When we think of today with Boris Johnson standing up with his scientific advisors with their graphs and their charts, that was what Lindemann did. That was his speciality, formulating very complex scientific concepts into simple graphs and charts that he could show to Churchill and explain what he was talking about. And that made him absolutely invaluable to Churchill.
We'll talk a little more about that sort of similarity between Boris Johnson and his scientific advisors today in a bit. But just talk me through Lindemann and Churchill. What do you think it was that made their friendship so strong?
Well, it must have been some sort of chemistry between them that they took to each other. Although, as I said, they were completely opposite in character. And ironically, since we were fighting Nazi Germany in the Second World War, Lindemann himself was German. He was the son of a German immigrant. He was born in Baden-Baden, in the Spa in Germany. He was educated at the University of Berlin, among others. But he disliked and detested Nazi Germany and Hitler, even though he himself was a believer in ideas that were pretty close to fascism. He was a eugenicist. He believed that the world should be run by an elite of high intellectual people, treating the population more or less as slaves. In fact, he believed that if you mucked around with genetics, you could produce a race who wouldn't want to be educated too far, who would act as slaves for this ruling elite. He believed in concepts like that. So his ideas were pretty close to fascism. He was a German, he was a teetotaler and vegetarian, and yet somehow he got on incredibly well with Churchill, who was the opposite of all those things.
But with those sorts of views, obviously not everyone was as keen on him as Churchill was.
You can say that again. He was extremely unpopular. He was arrogant. He thought that he knew best in everything, even when he was demonstrably wrong. And he was widely disliked. The only thing that kept him in place, and you can make maybe a comparison with a certain somebody today, who's also very close to the Prime Minister, also widely regarded as arrogant and disliked. I won't mention any names at this point unless you press me to do so. Lindemann was like that. So the key to his power was his friendship with Churchill. And he certainly was loyal to Churchill, stuck up for him. And when someone complained to Churchill about Lindemann, Churchill said, "Love me, love my dog." In other words, Lindemann was as close to him as a pet dog would be.
I couldn't possibly hazard a guess as to who you were referring to then, but let's go back to that correlation between Boris Johnson and his scientific advisors.
Yeah.
Do you think that there are real similarities between Lindemann and Churchill and that relationship they had? You mentioned the graphs. Do you think we're seeing that repeated again today?
I do. I think it's remarkable how similar they are, and particularly in a politician, a prime minister, who doesn't have a specific scientific education, like Churchill and like Boris Johnson, for example. I think blinded by science would go too far, but they have a great respect for scientists. And I think the danger is today, and was indeed the danger during the Second World War, is that if the Prime Minister concerned relies too heavily on one or a tiny group of scientists and blanks out everyone else, they may follow a wrong course. Luckily, Churchill, although he highly respected Lindemann, he didn't always follow his advice. For example, Lindemann was against radar. And radar was the thing that many historians believe saved Britain during the Battle of Britain in 1940. Lindemann had his own concept of infrared rays that he thought could warn of approaching enemy aircraft. And he did his best to talk down the concept of radar. In fact, the committee that was considering radar, which Lindemann got himself on, dissolved itself and then reconstituted itself under another name simply to bypass Lindemann and get round him and get rid of him, basically. So that was one of his big failures in the war.
Churchill himself was highly interested in technology, having seen firsthand the impact of technologies such as tanks and aircraft in World War One. But the dawn of World War Two was to throw this into sharp relief. Lindemann was involved in inventing things as well as, you know, being that scientific mind. Just tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, he got some things right, he got some things wrong. For example, he proved to Churchill that at one stage that we were producing more ships than were being sunk by the U-boats by enemy action. And he got a chart, which you can now see today in the cabinet war rooms in Whitehall, or you can when they're open, proving this at a glance, and he got that right. One thing that he got wrong, he did not believe that rockets could be fired. The rockets that the Germans were inventing towards the end of the war under another scientist, Werner von Braun, who was, of course, the father of the US space program after the war, known as the V-2 rockets.
Another launching with a great weapon leaping 65 miles skywards and reaching 3,000 miles an hour.
They went up into the atmosphere and then down, wreaking enormous damage when they were deployed very late in the war, too late to affect the course of the war. Lindemann simply didn't believe this. And when reports came out that the Germans were working on these super rockets, these V-2 rockets, he dismissed it. He said they would have to be the size of half a city to carry the fuel to power them. He didn't realise that Werner von Braun had developed a method of making liquid fuel very concentrated that could, in fact, power these rockets. So he got some things right, he got some things wrong. And Churchill was very good at picking out the things that Lindemann got right and rejecting the things that he got wrong.
What sorts of things did Lindemann come up with that Churchill was particularly keen on?
Area bombing. After Dunkirk, when Britain was more or less alone in fighting Nazi Germany, the one thing we did have was a fleet of bombers, of heavy bombers that could inflict terrible damage on Germany. Lindemann said, if you hit the working class areas of Germany, he didn't want to bomb the middle classes because he said they have gardens around them and the bombs will be wasted. But if you hit the crowded tenements where the working class, you will, A, destroy the German workforce, but also you will undermine the morale of the civilian population and they will collapse, and that will bring about the collapse of Nazi Germany.
This is the first daylight raid that the Army Air Forces have made on Germany proper. Our target was Wilhelmshaven. While the weather was none too good, we managed to get a large number of bombs on the target and in near vicinity.
So the very controversial policy of indiscriminate bombing of all the German cities, which by the end of the war had razed the major German cities to dust and ashes, that was Lindemann's big idea. That was his major contribution to the war effort, which for good or ill was one of the major things that formed the Allied campaign.
What do we know about what happened to Lindemann and also his relationship with Churchill?
Lindemann's relationship with Churchill became very crucial to both men. Churchill came increasingly to rely on him, and he is one of the earliest examples of history on someone who morphed from being a mere scientist, if you like, to being someone right at the heart of power in Britain. He was first of all made a Privy Councillor. Then after the war, he joined Churchill's cabinet when Churchill formed his second government in the early 50s. And Churchill ennobled him. He became Lord Cherwell. And he became not exactly a politician, but a person at the very heart of power. And Churchill increasingly, I think, came to rely on him. He was both a crony, an advisor, and in the end, one of the mainstays of Churchill's power.
And again, something perhaps we're seeing reflected today.
Absolutely something that we're seeing reflected today. It's widely thought that Boris Johnson lost a lot of political capital when he didn't sack Dominic Cummings for his misdemeanors over breaking lockdown rules, because he's very, very reliant on the advice of this one single man.
Is there a parallel between Churchill's reliance on the prof and the current government's reliance on scientists such as Chris Whitty and Patrick Vallance? And if so, can we learn anything from Frederick Lindemann, or as he later became, Viscount Cherwell? Obviously, we're talking about extremely different policies today
that the Prime Ministers
are looking at. But what do you think Boris Johnson can learn from that relationship that Churchill had with Lindemann?
I think not to rely too much on either a single man or a very small group of men, to take advice from as wide a circle as possible. For example, Churchill was extremely keen on Bletchley Park, which was another huge contribution to the war effort. Lindemann didn't have much to do with that. He wasn't at Bletchley Park. The number of people who knew that the codes were being broken, ciphers were being broken at Bletchley Park for obvious security reasons was very, very small. But Churchill relied on that and supported that work. And that was one of the major reasons why the Allies had an advantage and why they won the war in the end. Probably the most controversial aspect of Lindemann's advice, and this is one that is very relevant today, when a lot of historians accuse Churchill of being a racist, the example they usually give of his racism is his failure to supply food to India and Bengal in 1943, when there was an enormous famine in Bengal that killed between 1 and 4 million people.
India, more floods and more famine in a land swept by starvation. The death rate, already 1,000 a week, rises. India's long food shortage reaches a new crisis, the wake of a disaster that war and nature helped to bring.
On Lindemann's advice, he produced one of his charts. He said, look, at the rate that our shipping is being sunk by U-boats in the Battle of the Atlantic, unless we supply ourselves with food, the war will be lost. And that meant, of course, that there was less ships available to take much needed food supplies to Bengal, to India, with India, of course, then being part of the British Empire. And today, people accuse Churchill of doing that for racist reasons. It wasn't racist. It was a very cold calculation between saving lives in the British homeland and saving lives of Indians in Bengal. Similarly, today, I think, a government has to make a very careful calculation between saving lives of people afflicted by COVID and the damage being caused by a lockdown that is, for example, damaging people who have cancer, who have heart disease, other conditions, who can't get appointments, can't get diagnoses, can't get treatments, as well as the economic cost of long lockdown to the economy generally. That sort of cold, brutal calculation that politicians have to make. I can only say I wouldn't want to be in their shoes.
How important is the use of graphs, the use of sort of visual stimulation when it comes to prime ministers and their scientific advisers in that way?
Well, as we've seen in this year ourselves, every night on our TV screens, very important at conveying complex ideas not only to prime ministers and ministers, but also to the public. And this, I think, was one of the keys to Lindemann's hold over Churchill, that he could reduce complex scientific concepts to graphs, to flowcharts. He had a very good knack of doing that, to explain to Churchill, who was not a trained scientist, he was a very intelligent man, but that in simple terms, what this was. And I think that this is one of the secrets of the hold that Vallance and Whitty have over Boris Johnson, is that similarly, they can produce arguments in the form of charts and graphs to show that if we don't do lockdown, there's going to be 4,000 deaths a day by December, whatever.
There are signs that your work has been paying off, and we will continue as far as we possibly can to adopt a pragmatic and a local approach in the months ahead. But as we've also seen from those charts, we've got to be humble in the face of nature.
And I think because those charts are so stark and so frightening and frankly terrifying, I think that may have a huge influence, for good or ill, over Boris Johnson. It had an influence for good over Churchill in the terms of that we won the war. I'm not sure that they're having equally good influence over Boris today.
Why do you think that is? I mean, Lindemann then obviously used those graphs in a way in which gave the public evidence for the decisions that were being made. Do you think it's not having the same effect today?
When you've got a huge mass of data or information, you have to choose the crucial data that you're going to present. And I think it would be equally possible for scientists who are sceptical of lockdowns today to produce similar graphs and similar charts, reaching diametrically opposite conclusions to those that the nation has seen from Professors Whitty and Vallance.
People do talk about the blitz spirit that people went through during the first lockdown. Obviously, we're entering a second lockdown. Do you think that Boris Johnson can draw on what Churchill did, the way he spoke and the way he spoke to the public this time around?
I think that's beginning to wear a bit thin. Boris almost modelled himself as a Churchill Mark II. It's well known that he wrote a popular biography of Churchill. He uses Churchillian phrases. That's one of his strengths as a politician, is his use of language.
And in spite of the scoffing, in spite of the negativity, in spite of the scepticism that you will hear from the other side, we will work flat out to deliver it.
And I think the big difference is that Churchill was a politician that people turned to when things were really, really black and really bleak. He came to power at about the darkest moment of the war. His own party wasn't fully behind him. He was only supported by a minority until the tide turned and until people saw that Churchill was a real inspirer of national morale. Similarly, Boris carried all before him, if you like. He won the Tory leadership, then he came to power, won an election with an enormous majority on his promise to get Brexit done, and then within a matter of weeks, he's hit by what could almost be described as an existential crisis for the nation, the like of which we certainly haven't seen since the Second World War. And so far, he has not proved to have the Churchillian gravitas to inspire the nation. In other words, I think he's a politician for good times. I don't think, unlike Churchill, that he's a politician for these bad times that we're going through now.
And talking about his scientific advisers, Whitty and Vallance,
yes,
drawing parallels with Lindemann, obviously there's major differences. But do you think that, you know, the way that they're seen so closely with the Prime Minister in the public eye, it just makes that relationship a lot tighter than ordinarily you would see with the scientific advisers of Prime Ministers?
That's right. I mean, the old phrase is ministers advise and politicians decide. And in this case, medical advisers advise and politicians decide. Ultimately, the one who has to make the decision is the minister, or in this case, the prime minister at the top, and it's a terrible responsibility. Churchill had that tough streak in him that led him to be able to make a decision between life and death. Almost every day, he made decisions that cost the lives of hundreds, thousands of people, almost every day. And he could do that and sleep at night for doing so. I'm not sure that Boris has got that metal, that steel. I think he likes to be liked. Churchill liked to be liked as well, of course. But he didn't mind when he wasn't liked. His motto was, keep buggering on. However bad things got, keep buggering on. Boris has yet to demonstrate the same sort of steel, I think.
That's it for today. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to us and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google and Spotify. Thank you to Nigel Jones for joining us today. I'm Jenny Longden. Thank you for listening.